Starting with Pentateuch. And it's kind of fun, we're starting a new book. We've been in one book of the Bible, and it made me think earlier, it's like in this semester we cover all the longest books. But let's focus on Exodus for now, and we'll start with the five W's as usual. And this will go a little more quickly than some of the other books. The who is pretty easy. We believe it was written by Moses. And it's worth noting that anybody and everybody who believes the Bible believes it was written by Moses. There are some books where people believe that God inspired it, but they have some doubts if the traditional belief is true. But just about everybody, if they believe that God inspired the Bible, is in agreed that Moses wrote this. Mark 12, verse 26, is one place I'll reference. Jesus refers to the book of Moses. And he was specifically talking about the place where God spoke to Moses from the burning bush. But I think there's a wider application of all of the Pentateuch. Of course, the burning bush passage is one we'll look at, I'm hoping, before this morning is over. I'll also reference later in the book of Exodus, in 17, verse 14, there's one place where we see God commanded Moses to write something down. Now, it was the particulars about Amalek attacking and them having to defend themselves. So you could say, well, maybe he only wanted that part written down. But considering what you've got in front of you, I'm pretty certain God intended for Moses to write all that he did. Of course, we believe that God is ultimately the true author, you know, that he inspired what was written. And in some ways, we could say it seems more clear in the Pentateuch than others. Matter of fact, I'll refer to this later, I think, but it's Numbers 12, verse 8. Is the place where God is basically chastising Aaron and Miriam, and he tells them, I speak to Moses face to face. So that's something we'll see demonstrated throughout much of the rest of the Pentateuch. God coming and talking to Moses, you know, up close and personal. Interestingly, and this is the last point I'll make about the who, a part of the book of Exodus is autobiographical. Moses is going to tell us about himself. And so some people question why he did this, because he writes about himself in third person. You know, he talks Moses and he, not, rather than saying, I did this and this is what I was thinking. We don't have a specific answer, but it might be because he is representing God and telling the story. That's sort of my belief that, yeah, okay, it's me that I'm writing about, but I want to look at it from a higher plane and not just tell my own personal story, but this is the story of God doing what. We'll talk about that when we get to why and what. Instead, let's turn to when. Most of the book could not have been written sooner than Israel wandering in the wilderness after they left, you know, Egypt. You know, some of it could, but there's no reason to think that Moses was stopping every night and writing part of it down. And if Moses is the author, it must have been written before Israel entered the Promised Land. Right? So we can narrow it down to a 40-year window pretty quickly. And there's, you know, well, most people tend to think that a lot of it was probably written there at the base of Mount Sinai during the time, and we'll see it, they'll be there for about a year. You know, God, including the time that Moses is up on the mountain, God's giving instruction, they build the tabernacle and such. You know, it's possible that Moses started writing it all down later as they were wandering in the wilderness, but I tend to think he started on this sooner, and that's mostly my guess. Let me bring up something about which there's pretty strongly divided schools of thought, and that's when the Exodus itself occurred. And if you remember visiting Mr. and Mrs. Dean's house and watching that documentary near the beginning of the school year, it addresses that. So the two thoughts are, one is that the Exodus occurred about 1290 B.C., or sometime in the 1200s. I've seen 1250, 1225, so but around the 1200s. And this school of thought usually says that the children of Israel were in Egypt about 200 years. And I say about because there's some variations in that. And I'll mention this, it might not have been on your mind, but it's worth considering there is a point back in Abraham's life where God was revealing things. Abraham's in this trance, you know, or having a dark horror, and God gives him a prophecy. I believe it's Genesis 15, but I'd have to double check. But it says, your descendants will be slaves in a land not theirs for 430 years. Well, 430 years, God's not going to be mistaken. How could they have only been in Egypt a couple hundred? Well, the thought is, if they were in Egypt a couple hundred, the other time covers when Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were wandering in the promised land in a land not their own. And so there is an explanation, and that's, you know, the way that one fits. But the other school of thought puts the Exodus at about 1440 BC, so considerably earlier. Remember, we're on the timeline in negative numbers, moving back from zero. So 1250 is later than 1450. And most people, most scholars who believe that's the case, not all of them, but most believe that then the time in Egypt was the 430 years. So they were literally there for a longer period. I think more ministers in God's church subscribe to the earlier Exodus in the 1400s. And the documentary we watched did a pretty good job of putting evidence together for that. I don't think it strongly addressed how long they were there, but to me, I find a lot of that convincing, but I don't find it so convincing that I would stake my life on it, partly because it doesn't matter enough to stake your life on. They were there when they were there, and they left when they left, whether or not we know exactly when it happened. But you should, as Bible scholars, be aware that there's differences of opinion, and both have some support and evidence to help. Okay, the where is usually pretty easy. There's not a lot of controversy about this. Moses wrote Exodus sometime during the 40 years of wandering, and I think most of it at the base of Mount Sinai. So maybe it was right there, maybe it was some wandering. There is some dispute over where Mount Sinai was and is. Let me address that a little bit later. Matter of fact, I could at least introduce the idea. Traditional thought is Mount Sinai's here in the Sinai Peninsula. Okay, there is another interpretation that says, no, it's over here somewhere. Okay, we'll address that later, but we know they crossed the Red Sea. The question is, did they cross this part of the Red Sea or this part of the Red Sea? And we don't know for certain. There are a lot... And it's not something people are having fist fights over, but I'm sure, you know, in academia they can get close to that. You don't have to choose a side. I tend to lean towards over here based on the evidence that I've seen, but I'm not an archaeologist or an Egyptologist, so my opinion isn't worth as much as some of those guys. But just be aware that when there's a doubt about where, okay, they were at Mount Sinai. The question is, where was Mount Sinai? And there is a couple different ways of answering that question. Let's move on, though, to some questions we can answer more clearly. What is the book of Exodus? In short, it's the story of God delivering Israel from slavery and making those people, you know, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, making them into a special nation. So not only a nation, but a nation with a unique relationship with God. And we see that throughout the Bible. And sometimes there's one place where God says, you only have I known among all the nations. That doesn't mean God didn't know about the other nations, but he revealed himself and they had this special relationship. So that's part of the what, the story of God delivering Israel from slavery, entering a special relationship with that nation. Let me say, it consists mostly of narrative. Okay, so it tells a story, but also along with narrative, the codification of the law. So God, if we don't believe it's the origination of God's law, we could make a case it's the origination of some parts, and that's where we can break down the idea of what is law, because there's different ways of looking at it, and we deal with that in our lifetime. Like, thou shalt not kill is law in our minds, right? Okay, getting out on the freeway and maximum speed limit of 65 is also law, but they're different types of law, okay, and different punishments. So one way that this has been broken down as the types of law is sometimes we call it moral law. Mr. Myers, he refers to this as the gold standard, which is not a bad way of looking at it. But there's also civil law. Anybody got an idea of what in the world that's talking about? Okay, the law of the land, the law of a political body that applies to a specific area. Like, for instance, the United States has I know in Ohio we've got the Ohio Revised Code is the state law for Ohio. I'm guessing at some point in the distant past or distant enough, they had the Ohio Code and then later they revised it and it became known as the Revised Code. So there are laws in Ohio that are different than in Indiana or Michigan or whatever. So these are civil laws for a particular people in a particular place. One of the ways I demonstrate or talk about that, I remember last year, spring break came. Some of our students went up and visited some graduates that lived near Buffalo and wanted to see Niagara Falls. And so, spring break, I'm looking at my Facebook feed, and I see pictures of 18 and 19-year-olds in a restaurant holding up glasses of beer. What are they doing? They know they're underage. They're not allowed to drink. Am I going to have to deal with this? And oh, these were pictures taken in Canada, where the legal drinking age is 18. They weren't breaking any law. While they were in Canada, it was okay for them to drink. When they're in Ohio, the same people, it's not okay. So that's what I'm talking about by civil law. It's sort of regulated for particular people, a certain place and time, whereas the moral law is given by God. It's for all people for all time. You see? But God doesn't always make clear exactly which is which. In Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, but for the most part we can tell. But there's also one other that we often call ritual law or ceremonial, which what do you think that's referring to? Okay, Levitical law, but yeah, so the ritual pertaining to the tabernacle and then the temple sacrifice. It tends to be easier for us to say, oh yeah, that all of that doesn't apply to us because it was symbolic of Jesus Christ's sacrifice. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some things that are sort of carried over or renewed, and that's where it gets difficult to describe this properly. And I'll admit there are some people that are uncomfortable saying these are distinct because if they're all from God, they're all God's law. And I'm not saying that they're not, but face it, there are some things that we'll see in here that we don't think that we have to do today as Christians, and some things that we do. And we want to be able to explain why those things are, and that's one of the main purposes of this class. So that's why I'm stopping here to say, this. In Exodus we get a lot of this, but there's some of it in other places as well. And as I said, God didn't say, here's this law. One place we're pretty sure of the Ten Commandments nobody disputes is this. Except for some people say, well, except that fourth one, it belongs down here. You know, but that's one of the reasons we don't say it's there. It was set up in a certain way and we see it continued. But some of the others, it's like there's overlap and it's not as easy to be clear, but we don't have to be in total confusion or throw up our hands and say, oh, you can't know it. Because we can know a fair bit. Okay, having said that, we'll move on and the subject will come up again. But I'll mention the Exodus was written originally in Hebrew, to our knowledge. It consists mostly of prose, meaning the type of writing we normally do today, and not much poetry. The one place where we see poetry is in chapter 15. Moses writes the celebration song of praise after they leave Egypt. And we've got a version of that in our hymnal that we sing today. Always been one of my favorites. You know, Pharaoh's horsemen and his chariot sank into the churning sea. Okay, let's move on. Let's talk about why. Why is the book? Okay, Exodus serves many purposes. Let me mention some historical purposes. And again, there's overlap with what here. Some of the historical purposes were to describe the family of Jacob becoming the nation of Israel. Okay, another historical reason is to preserve examples. I've got it in my notes, examples/lessons for Christians. To preserve these examples as lessons for Christians, and I specifically put that here because of what Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 10. In 1 Corinthians 10, verses 11 and 12, he says, these things were written for our example. So a lot of the things that the Israelites did that turned out not to be good ideas and the punishment that happened to them could have just been left in the past and we didn't need to know, except we can learn from it. Okay, number three historical reason, it's a recording of God's powerful miracles. And let's not give this short shrift, also of God's great mercy. And that's one of the themes, ideas that comes up a few times, how merciful God is. So we see His miracles, His dealing with the people, and His great mercy. And then again, historical purpose, having a written form of the law. We use the term codification. I think it sounds fancy. Codify the law means write it down in a specific form. Yes, Guy? To describe Jacob's family becoming the nation of Israel. Okay, I've also got a list of doctrinal purposes. Not that there's no overlap. Yeah. Reason two was to preserve examples / lessons for Christians. So what happened to Israel as lessons for us today? You could say the whole Bible applies that way in a sense. At least all the history does. So we had preserving the examples for our lessons. Then we had recording God's miracles and His mercy. So basically, it's a history. And, of course, the codification of the law, both ritual, civil, and moral. So let me give you, I've got five on my list of doctrinal purposes. Somewhat arbitrary, other people could come up with a shorter list or a longer list. One, though, fits God's overall way of doing things, is to show redemption and deliverance. Redemption and deliverance. Israel is redeemed. They're delivered from sin, or they're delivered from Egypt. You can see where I'm going. That's an example of Jesus Christ redeeming us from the penalty of death and delivering us from slavery to sin. Okay, other doctrinal purposes. The institution of the Ten Commandments and the Holy Days. All the holy days won't be listed out here, but some of them will. And we see that God starts, and when I say doctrinal, it's like, okay, it's very clear. For all we know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob kept all the Ten Commandments. Matter of fact, remember Genesis 26:5 says Abraham kept God's statutes, judgments, and laws, but it's not all written down what they were. So we've got them written down here. The holy days, there's room to question. Were they keeping the holy days when Isaac was alive? I don't know. Okay, but we know from then on. Okay, number three I've got is we see a type of baptism. Basically, crossing through the Red Sea, the Apostle Paul, again in 1 Corinthians 10, says this was a type of baptism. So it's showing, you know, baptism is leaving the old way, the old life, the sin, which Egypt represented, going through the water and coming out to a new way of life, represented by going to Mount Sinai and having God's law revealed. Yes, Julie? Okay, four, if you're ready for this, and I question whether I should list this as doctrinal, but I think some other people did this, but we see the beginning of God fulfilling His promises to Abraham. So He begins to remember all those great promises He made. Said, get out of your country, go to a land that I'll show you, I'll make of you a great people, and I'll do this. And the promises kept getting bigger and bigger. And He made those promises to Isaac. He made those promises to Jacob. And I wouldn't say they said, where are they? Although at one point Abraham said, God, what are you going to give me considering I don't have any kids? You said my descendants will be like the sand of the sea. I don't even have one. Well, later he had more than one because he had Ishmael and then he married Keturah. But here we see the beginning of that. And I say doctrinal because part of our doctrine is that God worked with the nation of Israel. And we see prophecies fulfilled. So God fulfilling those promises is vital to a lot of the other things that we teach and understand of God's plan. Okay, so, I just realized number five on my list could have been put right after number three or could have been combined with number three, but I'm going to give it to you since I've got it here. And that's the idea that coming out of Egypt is symbolic of Christians coming out of sin. So again, I said this is somewhat of an arbitrary to have it at five because now I'm looking at it, I would combine five with three, and I'm wondering now why I haven't. But probably because I don't want to have to retype and reprint these notes. Okay, I've got one other thing I'll mention, and I've got three of these to just want to mention that there's symbolism of Christ in Exodus, symbolism of the Messiah, and some specific ways that are worth knowing. One is Moses himself serves as a type of Jesus, and that Moses is a deliverer and a leader. So he leads the people out of Egypt. You know, he's the instrument through which God saves people from Egypt, whereas Jesus Christ is the instrument by which the Father saves us from sin. So Moses is sort of a type of Christ. And I'll remind you, we've looked more than once where God told Moses, "See, I'll raise up a prophet like you." And I said that can apply to how God communicated from then on, but in the New Testament, they clearly say that was talking about Jesus Christ. So Moses is a symbol in that way. The most obvious one, matter of fact, maybe I should have asked this. So if I say, what's the biggest symbol of Christ in the book of Exodus? Probably something pops into mind, I hope. What do you think of right away with Exodus? Passover is what I'm getting at. The Passover lamb. You know, they didn't have a Passover lamb before this. That's not to say there were no sacrifices, and that's important when I talk about instituting ritual law, actually something that's going to come up in Jeremiah. So there were sacrifices before, but this specific system of worship will be instituted using sacrifices. And one of the things you'll see on that chart that I referred to that Mr. Myers will give you, sacrifices were there before, and then there's this type of sacrifice, and then I mentioned, I think going through Peter, that we still have sacrifice. But the New Testament speaks of spiritual sacrifice. Remember, present your body as a living sacrifice, the fruit of your lips, the sacrifice of praise, and so on of that. So there are some things that are transformed in the newer covenant, but don't disappear and didn't begin at Mount Sinai. Is that clear? Okay. I had one more symbolism of Christ, and that is, I have the word tabernacle. But you could say tabernacle slash temple to come. And some people refer to the tabernacle, the tent, where the worship was done, was temporary. And it was movable on purpose. And some liken that to Christ's first coming. He came in a fleshly body that was temporary. But then later there was would be a temple built that was permanent as much as anything on earth can be permanent, which is not entirely because the temple is not there anymore. But that might be compared to Christ's second coming, which will be permanent. He'll come in the spirit form, and that won't be temporary at all. But see, the tabernacle, and in a way, we'll talk about this, the tabernacle represented communication with and worship of God in a way that Jesus Christ opens the way now for us to go directly to the throne of God in prayer. Not literally, because we don't have an escalator that'll get us there, but speaking figuratively. Whew, boy, I thought I was going to go a lot faster. So that's my five W's. Okay, I've got my next page said Exodus 1, verse 1. We're going to dive into the text. Starts off with, now these are the names of the children of Israel. The Hebrew name for this book is names. So I guess in the syntax, perhaps the word names appears first. I'm not sure, but I'll bet Dr. Britt's going to check on it. But that's the Hebrew name, the Jewish name would have been names. So the word Exodus comes from the Septuagint translation, and then in which the Greek going through Latin, the Exodus is from the same base word as our word for exit, which you see up there, which means going out. You know, so if I make an exit, I'm leaving. Well, that's what this book is about: the Israelites exiting from Egypt. And then we have a listing again from verses 2 through 5, basically. The brothers, the patriarchs who went down, mentions Joseph was already there, and it says, yeah, there were 70 in all in verse 5. We covered that at the end of the book of Genesis. Okay, the 70 we think included Joseph, Ephraim, Manasseh, and Jacob himself. And it's worth, if you want to make the note again, in Acts 7, in Acts 7, verse 14, Stephen the martyr mentions 75. And I explained that we believe that's because the Septuagint version of the Bible that he would have normally read mention 75 because it included, they believe, grandchildren that were born to Ephraim and Manasseh. There are some other interpretations of how they get to it. And, you know, to me, the important thing to remember is it's not a contradiction. The Bible doesn't contradict itself, but sometimes we have to understand why it seems to say things differently, slightly different ways. Okay, of course, in verse 6, Joseph died and all his brothers, all that generation. It means time is passing by. They're there for quite a long time, either 200 or 400 years, but they're doing something. Verse 7, the children of Israel were fruitful, increased abundantly, multiplied, grew exceedingly mighty. The land was filled with them. There's five different ways it talks about how fast they're reproducing. So they're having a lot of kids. And I think it's interesting you talk about synthetic parallelism. Although this isn't meant to be poetry, it says it in five different ways that they're having a lot of kids. And that's one thing that leads us to believe if they were only there a couple hundred years, it seems likely there were a number of multiple births, twins, triplets, and such. Twins aren't out of possibility. Of course, it happens in all societies, and there was some in the family with Esau and Jacob. So we don't know. If the sojourn was 400 years, it wouldn't have had to be so fast, but still, they seem to be growing in numbers at a much faster rate than the Egyptians. And we could speculate different reasons. The biggest, most important one is God was causing it. Maybe not as much infant mortality as among the Egyptians. Maybe it just made them more fertile. I think, what is the word, fecund comes to mind, which I've seen that in books, with F-E-C-U-N-D. That just means able to get pregnant faster. So, of course, that applies to soil, too. It means fertile. But it's beginning to fulfill that promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob of them having many descendants. And we move on, because we're moving ahead real quickly, buzzing across centuries. In verse 8, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, look, the children of Israel are more and mightier than we are. Let's deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply and it happen. In the event of war, they join our enemies and fight against us and go out of the land. I find that intriguing because they're scared of them, but they don't want them to leave. It's indicating that they're gaining wealth and benefit from the Israelites being there. But if we think in a society where most people are illiterate, and I say most without knowing for sure how many were illiterate, we don't have records that'll tell us that, but it's easy to imagine people forgetting their past. And, you know, as centuries go by, not having much knowledge. So this person of Joseph, who was such a great figure, you know, when the Israelites came in, maybe is just somebody, maybe somebody heard of, and maybe they didn't. I was thinking of people that were well known in America 100 or so years ago, not even 200. I think I mentioned Theodore Roosevelt. He's one whose face sort of people know. He's on Mount Rushmore. What about William McKinley? I've read some accounts saying McKinley was as good or better a president than Roosevelt. I don't agree with that, but most of us say, oh yeah, I've kind of heard that. What did he do? What's he known for? Go back, you know, 200 years. Who was the governor of Virginia in 17-something? Well, actually, Thomas Jefferson was for a while. Who was the governor of Ohio? Well, there wasn't one. So, but what I'm saying, it's not hard to imagine. I should mention that word know is yada. Yada can mean to know or have knowledge of, but it can also mean to acknowledge or to approve. So a new pharaoh comes who might not acknowledge Joseph. Well, it wasn't that big of a deal what he did. Or I don't approve. Now, let me give you some history / speculation, because this is a big deal that, you know, hey, they're favored, give them the best of the land, take care of them. Now we're going to turn them into slaves. A lot of scholars think that Egypt, we know that they experienced a change of dynasty. You know, a dynasty is the descendants of a particular family ruling. And at some point in this distant past, a group called the Hyksos invaded. The Hyksos are commonly called the Shepherd Kings. And they ruled for some time, and then they were driven out, and the native-born Egyptians returned. So a popular interpretation says that Joseph came and was prime minister during the Hyksos period, and that when later the native Egyptians came in, they didn't like the Israelites. And okay, if that's true, that interpretation fits more with the 200-year sojourn and would make the Pharaoh of affliction, as basically the Pharaoh Moses dealt with, Ramses II. Another way of looking at it, if the Exodus happened further back in time, at an earlier date, which I tend to lean towards, but I'm not that certain, that would say that Joseph came in under a native-born Egyptian. So it was a real Egyptian that, you know, put Joseph in charge. And then later the Hyksos came in. And so the Pharaoh of oppression was one of these shepherd kings. And that's why it's like, I don't know anything about this Joseph guy and what he did. And that would fall in line making Thutmose III the Pharaoh of oppression and fit more with a 400-year sojourn. And again, I'm not asking that you memorize the stuff about this, but it's good that you be aware that there's different interpretations on the chronology. Okay? And there's a logical explanation rather than just, boy, these guys had bad memories and didn't like the Israelites. And the fact that they enslaved them, as we go on in verse 11, therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. They built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. And the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. The Egyptians made them serve with rigor, made their lives bitter with hard bondage and mortar and bricks. And it's we see later they're involved in producing brick. And they're using those to build cities and such. Remember, there's a longer period of time than we might think from just reading this. So this was probably a progression. It wasn't one day, oh, you're my buddy, you're great. The next day, I'm making you a slave, you know. Because what do people do when that happens? They rise up in revolt. They say, no way. But if you do things gradually, maybe at first, instead of having the best of the land for free, you need to start paying us rent, tribute money. And then maybe it progresses to, now we need you to start serving in a workforce occasionally so much time. And then, you know, the tribute goes up. And eventually, you know, they become perhaps a type of peasant or serf and eventually abject slaves. And that could have happened over a course of generations. This is me speculating, by the way, so take it for what it is. You know, I can't say for certain that they didn't walk out and make them slaves in one day. It does seem, it talks about them working them hard. The idea is that you work them so hard that they'll tend to be weak and disorganized so that they won't rise up in revolt. Perhaps also it's intended that it'll slow down the birth rate. They're going to be tired, too tired even for that. The first seemed to be successful. They didn't rise in revolt or organize. They submitted, but the birth rate didn't slow down. Oh, I've got a note here that the archaeology in ancient Egypt shows that there were a lot of buildings made with brick. So the story of they're producing a lot of brick and building cities, they found archaeological evidence that fits that, and many bricks bearing the name of Thutmose III. So, you know, which could have been the pharaoh that was partly responsible for this. Okay, so, yes, Emily?
So if the bricks did say that, then wouldn't it be the Egyptians that had taken over and not the other group?
No, I believe that interpretation says that this Thutmose III was one of the Hyksos. And by the way, these Hyksos became, for what we understand, pretty much Egyptianized. And it's sort of, I think it was clearer than this, but I'm thinking, you know, there was a time in the United States history when Irish were looked at as sort of invaders. These poor Irish coming and filling the cities. Oh, and we don't like them. We're making them live in slums. But as time went by, they got better jobs. They moved out. Eventually, we have John F. Kennedy, an Irish, you know, a president who has Irish descent. Whereas, you know, 80 years earlier, that would have been unheard of. So these Hyksos, over time, are looked at as Egyptian in some ways. I'm not sure if they became as thoroughly integrated because, you know, apparently later they're driven out. So I'm kind of guessing at how that worked. But they would have adopted the title and the culture and things like that. They were called Pharaoh. Okay, so we see in verse 15, we get introduced to a couple ladies that we don't know much about. Because the king of Egypt now spoke to the Hebrew midwives. One was named Shifra, the other Pua. Aren't you glad you weren't named Pua? He said, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew woman, see them on the birth stools. If it's a son, kill him. If it's a daughter, save it alive. But the midwives feared God and didn't do it. Well, good. They're not going to murder these innocent babies. The king of Egypt called and said, why have you done this and saved the male children? They've got a ready story. They say, well, the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They're not worn out and tired. They're strong, and they give birth before we get there. Therefore, God dealt with the midwives, and the people grew mightily. Because the midwives feared God, he provided households for them. Okay, I'll come back and address a couple things. Sky, you had a question.
When it says Hebrew midwives, were they Hebrew or were they Egyptian midwives that worked with the Hebrews?
I believe they were Hebrew.
Okay, then if they were slaving the Hebrews, why would the king talk to the Hebrew midwives? And if they were Hebrew, then he would have known that they feared God. Why would he have given them that command?
Well, one of the things I would say is anytime you have an enslaved society, you have some who are slaves that you give position and work through. Like you've probably studied in the American South, they had what were called slave drivers who were slaves, but they were in charge of some of the other slaves. And they were held accountable if they didn't push them to get the work done. It's entirely likely that Pharaoh made this communication through other officers, although I wouldn't say it had to be that way. Another thing I would presume is these two perhaps are the chief midwives. Because if we got this group growing up to be eventually a couple million people, and they're having babies like crazy, you think there's got to be more than only two women that can help deliver babies. You know, for all we know, there might have been, you know, midwife training, and these are the two that train others and sort of oversee. I'm kind of guessing at this, but the question has come up, come on, are two going to be enough? And one answer is, yeah, maybe not, but maybe these two are the top ones or the leaders. Some question comes up what this birth stools is. The Hebrew there is oben, O-B-E-N, and it means literally two stones. So when they say the woman, they see the woman on the birth stools, well, I'll say that oben is usually translated one of two ways, either stool, and I mean like sitting on stool, not the other kind, or wheel. So one thing is it's talking about the midwife sitting on a stool, you know, waiting to catch the baby when it comes out. I'm simplifying, you know, I think comedians, okay, get my catcher's mitt, I'm going to catch him when he comes out, but usually there's more involved. You know, having been in the delivery room now, I know they're looking at dilation and this and that. And another thing, though, is sometimes some believe this might be referring to a stone trough, which would be maintained nearby. So a water container made of stone in which they would wash the babies. Because that's another thing we still do today. After a baby's delivered, you wash it up. And the implication is Pharaoh's telling him if it's a baby boy, don't just wash him, drown him. Yeah, we're not sure exactly what this was, but it fits. And I tend to lean more towards some type of stool than the wash, you know, trough, but I'm not sure that we have to know. Either way, the midwives would not practice murder. And they might have been partly telling the truth. These hard-working Hebrews who might have been following already dietary laws and such maybe are just healthier and they're able to give, you know, deliver without having that much help. We don't know. I think, and then we move on to another command. Since that didn't work, in verse 22, Pharaoh commanded all his people saying, every son who is born, throw him in the river. And the daughters you can save alive. I'm going to speculate here based on what we see later in the narrative that this command was probably only in effect for a short time and even then was probably not well obeyed. We have the most famous example of somebody not obeying it is Moses himself, who we will meet in the next chapter. But I'll say, we don't have the story of the older kids. We'll see later clearly that Aaron is 3 years older than Moses. So this command seems to have come about after Aaron was born because there's no story about how Aaron was saved. And we don't know for sure. I mean, this is another case of the Bible not telling us something we don't need to know. But it's possible that the command was instituted sometime between when Aaron was born and when Moses was born. And we don't know how much longer it lasted after Moses, because we don't hear about it going on and on. And I can imagine, as we'll see the story, Pharaoh's daughter brings in this Hebrew baby. Oh, look, isn't he cute? I'm going to keep him. And Pharaoh's probably like, oh, Okay, I got to undo that order so I don't have more and more Hebrew babies brought in here. And Pharaoh's daughter might not have been the only Egyptian who's, you know, picking up the cute ones and adopting them. Again, this is me kind of speculating, but what we'll see here, the results of this edict in chapter 2, we only see addressed for what seems to be a short time. And my suspicion is that, okay, that's not working, we'll do something else. Yes, Emily.
I've always wondered this. Would they have looked very different? Would it have been really obvious, like, oh, okay, they're definitely Hebrew and they're definitely Egyptian? Because I wonder that with Moses being in the court and everything, if everyone was always looking at him kind of funny because he didn't look the same.
Yeah, the implication is that they did. That, I mean, and if you follow the, if you look back in Genesis 10 at the Table of Nations, our understanding is that the Egyptians were descended from Cain and the Israelites from Seth. And so the Egyptians probably were more dark-skinned. There's variety within all of those. So that's the idea is, okay, that you could tell by looking. But we don't know for sure how much. Yes, Guy?
Another thing, too, is that back in Genesis, it said that the Egyptians refused to eat with the Israelites.
Oh.
So then if they didn't like them so much, then why were they picking them up and keeping them and then raising them as their own children?
Might have been a cultural thing that changed over the course of a couple centuries. It's hard to say, yeah. And one of the things I would mention, I think I did that thing, oh, it's an abomination to eat with an Israelite, or I think they said a Hebrew. You know, people of other nations tended to use that word rather than Israelite. That might have been derived from them not wanting to eat with any foreign peoples. You know, if there had been some Edomites or some of any others, they might have specified Hebrews because that's who was there, but they might have had this, we're better and all that, we don't want to fellowship and eat with them. But it's different when you get the baby and raise them. And I'm speculating, but one thing I could say is if you go back a couple hundred years in American history, most white Americans looked down at American Indians and kind of despised them, thought of them as like an inferior life form. But at times, if they got them as babies or children, they would adopt them and raise them. Andrew Jackson being the most notable example. He's derided as being the author of The Trail of Tears, but he raised an Indian baby as his own son and had great affection for him. And just how can you explain that? Well, because people are weird and complicated. Okay, let me cover a couple verses before we get into this. In chapter 2, it says, a man of the house of Levi, so remember he's descended from that son of Jacob, went and took as a wife the daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bore a son. He was a beautiful son. She hid him 3 months. We know that this is Moses. There's some interesting thought. We could read right over this, and I'll make a reference to later. In chapter 6, verse 20, we have names attached, but we're not absolutely certain. There's some question about the chronology here. In Exodus 6, verse 20, it mentions Amram and the wife being Jochebed. And I've always thought Amram was a cool name, and Jochebed's okay. For them to be the parents of Miriam, Aaron, and Moses barely would fit with the long lives of an Israelite sojourn in Egypt of 150 to 200 years, or 230. So it might be true, and I don't want to discount the Bible, but if the sojourn was 430 years, some scholars have suggested that we don't have the complete chronology. And what this is doing, what we get later in Exodus 6, is an abbreviated chronology. So it lists the tribe, which is Levi. It'll mention the clan being Kohath, and then a subfamily group of Amram. But mentioning there might be a gap of some generations that aren't listed. And I'm not invested either way, and we'll see this when we get to chapter 6. But there are some reasons we think this. One being how much time there is and how old are when you're having babies. One is that Numbers 3, verses 27 to 28, and we get the start of Numbers, there's a listing of all these families, and it lists many Amramites by the time of Exodus, and that seems odd to say. Many descendants of Amram, whereas this seems to say, hey, this dude named Amram got married and had these three kids, Miriam, Aaron, and Moses, but, well, where are all these other ones? Unless Amram was not Moses' direct father, but was his ancestor. And the Hebrew for descendant and son is pretty much the same, and it goes backwards, father and ancestor. I'll mention one other thing, and maybe I should have waited till chapter 6 to bring this up, but this is where it's first introduced. 1 Chronicles chapter 7. 1 Chronicles 7, verses 25 to 27, list the descent from Joseph down to Joshua. You remember Joshua, you know, servant of Moses who took over for him? He was a descendant of Joseph, and there were 10 generations from Joseph to Joshua. And they're listed. Okay, 10 generations, and then would that make sense for the number of generations from Levi to Moses to only be 2 or 3, depending on how you count it? It's like it just starts getting difficult. So the idea of this being an abbreviated or what we see in verse 6 or chapter 6 being abbreviated starts seeming like a possibility. So I'm only going to present it as a possibility, but the point I'm getting at is here it doesn't even give the names. And that's the way we see it. Just some guy who's a Levite married a woman who's a Levite, and they had this baby that they're going to stick in a basket out in the river. And I'm saying that quickly because it's time for us to take a break.